Blog Talk Radio.
Have that talent. Welcome to North Carolina.
Have that talent.
Have that talent.
I'm gone.
Got that rhythm.
I'm gone.
Have that talent.
I'm gone.
Got.
Come on.
Family, try to picture in your mind a Native American standing in front of his tribe, singing the death song. Nothing lived long but the earth and the mountains, saying, white antelope and black kittle went into negotiation with American soldiers. They were Cheyenne, the Cheyenne Nation. Once more, they assumed that they could have a treaty with the Paleface. Upon going into negotiation, antelope was given the emblem of peace, and black kittle was given the flag of the United States, indicating they had a treaty. However, little did they know that they would be attacked and that their camp would be killed off. Their camp was attacked, and the Cheyennes once again have lost the treaty. Their families and loved ones were killed. Black kittle sang the death song. Nothing lives long but the earth and the mountains, as he stood in front of his campground and was murdered. As he stood there, black kittle began to search for his wife and his loved ones. He found his wife with 9 bullets in her, but she was still holding on for dear life. At that particular treaty, which was broken once more, the Cheyennes once again realized that even waving the white flag could not render them helpless, sort of like what is going on in our nation. When troops are not armed, why would someone come in with tanks rolling up on that city to embark upon killing, the same way the Native Americans had death come to their doorstep? Welcome to the Care to Read Show. You've got Sherelle M. Garth under the name of Omi Inca 7, and bringing you another nation story on everything you ever wanted to know you learned in social studies class. You're in the social studies class of Omi Inca Zanu. As we talk about the Cheyennes today, we'll talk about the great many treaties that were broken and the 500 nations that were forced to move out of the East into the West. We'll talk about George Armstrong, Custer, as they fought a great war. And on that battleground, many fell dead, Americans as well as Cheyennes. The park ground was named after Custer, however, and it should have shared the great battle of many people, because Black Kittle walked away with his wife, and his family were murdered, and there was 100 people killed later on. They came back and killed Black Kittle and his wife. So they didn't rest until they moved these people off their land. They couldn't rest. However, the Cheyenne story will live on through many people, and we'll be talking more about various different highlights of the Native Americans' great wars. And I want you to understand that your history is the Native Americans' history, and don't let anyone tell you any different. The Iñárritu Nation, part of the next door neighbor, Cheyenne, they knew exactly about the falsification of these treaties, because they had many treaties that were broken. And there were many leaders that were out front who were speaking out in an effort to bring about treaty and peace. Why is it Chief Joseph, being an outstanding part of the Norwalka tribe, asked for peace? And he pleaded with the army to bring about peace, but they still continued to break treaty after treaty after treaty. The food that they promised, the clothing, the various different hardwares that they needed for their home that were promised them were falsified, and they never received any of these goods to make it through the winter. Think back and try to remember Geronimo, the great Geronimo. He was known for the great Geronimo. And we have to remember when he turned and looked around and saw that once again another treaty was broken with the great Geronimo. Geronimo was never captured, however. He went out to fight, and most of their men had to surrender, but Geronimo went off to himself, and he was never found, and he was never captured. He was victorious once again in war. Now, I'm talking about war today because war has been raised upon the black people, primarily because of their skin tone. And when we have race become a factor in why we will wage war, you are talking to the original warriors of war. However, we are peaceful people, and we want to live peaceful, and we demonstrated that in many occasions. Now, they're saying that the situation is going on in St. Louis, that this young boy wanted this killing because he stole something from a store. There are proper ways of chastising someone in a court of law. You do not have to break out in a riot to indicate that someone has done something wrong. There's many things that have been stolen from us and our country and our people, and never once have we waged war on the United States. Yes, war has been waged on the African Americans, and it's come to our doorstep in our home, and it's followed us all the way up to now, and the chief and the police cannot explain it away. They have to be retrained. They have to be retrained not to use ammunition because they're not equipped and skilled enough to use them in a crowded segment to keep peace. They are not skilled enough once again. They must learn how to be neighbors and how to be our keeper and how to be our protector in our community and walk the beat like all of the other old policemen did. I have two family members that are policemen, and I have nothing but regard for policemen who are ready to settle issues with peace rather than with the gun. It doesn't prove that there are any greater man when they have to pull out their billy club or their gun to beat somebody down. They have the upper hand. They have the law on their side. But on this situation, contrary, my friend, they do not have the law on their side. They will have to attend court and have to go through the cross-examination like any other villain who may have pulled a gun to kill someone. To kill someone is the ultimate tactic, and I think we can look at other options. But yet, 90 other cities have connected with this Valendon, with this violent situation that has occurred to also riot in their particular states and countries. Look at what has happened because of one man's blow. If we could meet each other with an open hand and not a closed fist, we could have turned that riot around. But because we have a situation of overtrained people for the wrong climate, Will they bomb missiles on us next? Will that tear gas and pepper spray begin to injure those that are innocent bystanders? This has to stop. These are soldiers waging war on people, and this is not how we keep peace. And we are going to continue to talk about this story because it is a threatening situation to all of us, to teachers alike. Some of them are even being preyed upon, even in their homes, while asleep at home in their beds. And as you know, on Monday, we talked about a situation from one young lady who was a teacher that had it happen to her. And because she had not been charged with anything, she was just mistakenly identified in her own home. So we are going to have to look at what other alternatives do we have. How do we resolve this problem? Can we sit back and say, oh, the policeman was just doing his job? Well, what about if he came to the white neighborhood? They would not stand for him to come to the white neighborhood to have all-out war. They would not stand for it. Somebody would have to pay the price and have to be brought up on charges. Now, I would say that we are treated quite differently than other communities, and we are handled with kid gloves in a different manner. But maybe we'll handle to the point where we are over assessed because we are thought of as criminals from the first place. Every man deserves a fair trial. And even that young man who was stealing in the store deserved a fair trial, not a bullet to his body. Now, I'm going to leave you with the understanding that you have to look at how do we govern ourselves better. Why would someone jeopardize themselves in a community, African Americans, I'm talking to you, in a community where we steal something out of a store that didn't belong to us and then get disrespectful to the authority, knowing that they are going to retaliate? We do not have to bring this frustration upon ourselves and our community because we want to do what we want to do. And now look at the community in uproar because of one man's sin. By one man's sin do we all enter into death. Is this a death sentence for all communities that are lower socioeconomic? Is this a situation we're going to see happen whenever the police department decides to make a point? Or is this a situation where we are going to have to stop retaliating against one another? We see it all across the city, the state, retaliation, people getting back at each other. How can we live like this? We have to learn to live better than what we're living, and we have to learn to understand that by one man's verdict of assassination, it indicts all of us because many things could have been done to evade the situation that happened there in St. Louis, Missouri. Now, the people are uproar. They want some answers. They want to know why hasn't the policeman come to visit them and been a part of their community and a part of their tribe to sit and break bread with them as a protector. When we send people into the community who are not familiar with the community and don't know the pulse of the people, they become strangers. They act impromptu and act prematurely, and that's exactly what happened. Now we have all-out war on a nation within a nation. These are the kind of things you expect to happen in third world countries, not here in the United States. And we're going to be talking about it for a while. Native Americans, as you look back on their history, you see the same trail of tears where many have been driven out of their communities and many have been fired upon and many have been slain right there in the heat of the night in their teepees, in their pueblo dwellings. Many have gone through this. We see the same thing, history repeating itself. When will it stop? How can we help it to stop? And what can we say today that can make a difference? We can say many things, teachers. Get up off your high knees and start talking about what needs to be corrected. You are the leaders that need to go out front. When you're so afraid that your job needs to be protected, that you won't tell the truth, and you rather hide behind a gutter curriculum rather than telling the truth of what we need to do as teachers to make a better education system, then you are not fit to be teaching in our school system. A dollar bill is not all we're there for. We're there to leave a legacy behind for these children who are about to embrace another school year that is toe-up from the floor. And I mean that. You got administrators that can't make up their mind if they got money in the budget. You got people stealing from one another, taking the pensions, and then yet you say hold your head up with pride and teach the children. Yet you say go in the classroom and keep your mouth closed so you'll keep a job. And some of us are dancing to that tune. But teachers need to come out front. We need to say enough is enough. Every year we shouldn't be deciding on whether or not the school year is going to start, who's going to be the favorite teacher that go in, who's got the most clout, not who's got the best skill, but who's got the most clout and who's rubbing shoulders and rubbing somebody's paws to get into a position that they are not qualified. It's been too long that some of these districts have kept waste and excess in their departments who were not fit to teach and shouldn't have been in the classroom, but yet they lingered on. Now we come to this situation where the buildings are deteriorating and the teachers are not fit and they have to replenish them. If they had have been monitoring these teachers all along, training them to do professional development, sending them back to school, putting them on sabbatical to get help, then they would have better teachers. If they had corrected the problems in the buildings, and refresh the buildings, we would have better schools and we wouldn't have to close them all down. And we find attrition where people are running from certain districts, going to other districts because they want justice and good education. Well, we can provide good education in all of these schools, but we've got to address the real problem and stop covering it up. Top-heavy administration gaining too much money and doing very little service for it, it has to stop. Some of these people in administrative position have no business being there. People that come in with credentials like myself and others with master's degree and have administrative skills from corporate industry ought to be given a chance to come in and run the establishment if we ran corporations. Well, how much does it take for you to know to run a corporation? Just a type 75? Is that all you need? Maybe you might need some administrative skills in the real Fortune 500 world. Then you will know how to manage people and how to delegate. Part of the problem is inappropriate ability to delegate, to pass down assignments to those who can. Right now we have those who can't in operation and they don't know how to delegate and they have no business being in an administration position. It's a shame when I find that we talk about English as a second language when our children that are African Americans have not even learned English as the first language. And yet we're pushing for immigrants to learn this language of ours called English, and our first language here in the United States is African, is being denied the opportunity to teach grammatical English in the classroom because we have teachers that refuse to go back to school to learn the modern English and the new grammatical English to teaching these children, and they don't have the necessary skills to go in front of a class and call the children to the board to do dictation or to sound out the sounds because they haven't learned them themselves. Now, I'm down on what I'm seeing because I'm calling it like a TI is, and I'm a little bit tired of it. Those of us who were great teachers and who demanded more of our parents and our children, those are the ones who were given the less insignificant job. And when they shined on those jobs, then they begin to look at them and say, what are you doing in the classroom teaching instead of promoting them to excellence, to administration, to get them to duplicate themselves, to get them to carry out that process throughout the district to replicate it. Instead, you bring in people that are your friends that you have in your back pocket to lead and to direct who you and we know that are not ready. Yes, you have to pay some dues, and we know that. And yes, a lot of us have paid many dues, and we're still paying dues. But the school system cannot be shortchanged. The children don't have a second time to come back and learn the foundation of literacy, grammar, grammatical grammar, proper grammar, and they don't have the opportunity to repeat themselves once they're out of school. They have to be self-trained and retaught on their own with their own monetary gain, and they've wasted their time in the school system. Now, I want to speak to the general teachers at large all over the nation. Excuse me, right now we should be in uproar that every urban setting is going through a transition. Every urban setting is going through a turmoil because there's so much that needs to be done in the school system. Let's go back to the little schoolhouse on the prairie. Let's talk about having smaller family child care and starting with family child care to develop our family child care mothers into teachers so that they will funnel those children into the school ready to learn, not just coming to school for socialization, but ready to learn, ready to read, and coming into the classroom with more than 5,000 words, breaking down the Ebonics so that they can express to the teacher, I have more than 5,000 words, and I'd like to bring my lessons from home to class. Teachers, you've got to be more sensitive to know darn well that African-American children are articulate and they sure come to school with more than 5,000 words and they can express that if you give them a chance. But you have to look at acknowledging what they bring from home and don't discount that they are having sessions of learning at home. Somebody's at home every once in a while. Somebody comes up out of their stupor and they interact with that child because African-American children are automatically articulate and they come here from a literary background. So we've got to stop this thing of indicting these children, putting indictments on the black boys, placing them in special ed, funneling them off to a no-nonsense school where they're not learning at all. You got good kids that have good brains, that want to advance themselves, that need more than just a little teaching. They need one-on-one and reteaching. And you need to give it to them and take them off the death rolls of the special ed department where you're gaining most of your dollars. I'm telling it like a TIE is. I don't care who likes it. This is what I've seen over my 30-some-odd years in the system. And I'm getting sick and tired of us having to pass on paperwork because it is our responsibility to identify, to assess, and to refer children to special ed as if they are cattle that we're referring down the line to only end up in our penal institution. We got to turn this thing around. It's a lot wrong with our system, and we're starting with the school system first. And if you have a problem with it, I am a teacher. So I'm not just indicting those out there. I'm saying there's a lot that we can do and I can do, and I'm doing my part. How about you? Let's take a station identification, and we'll come back to you under the song of Adore. For joining the Curator Reroom. You've got your Omi Inca 7 live coming to you straight from my studio. I'm here in the community bringing you the topic of everything I ever wanted to learn. I learned in social studies class. Yes, you're in a class. Thank you so much for joining us. Now let's reflect back on a little history. sitting here reflecting back on June 25th, 1976, Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse were gathering together in their camp while George Custer advanced on them in their camp while they were sleeping. Custer and his men advanced on this camp, killing all the men and the women. However, in 1876, the sentence of the celebration called for this particular killing, they thought. And Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse realized that the treaty was once again broken. And this was at the Wounded Knee. Most of you may know the history of the Wounded Knee and Crazy Horse. That's what they call the Wounded Knee during this killing that took place. And they snuck up on them in the middle of the night without them knowing it. However, ladies and gentlemen, you ought to know your history. There's wars that have been waged in the middle of the night while camps were sleeping. And the Native American are no different. They set the pace for telling you what the history is and how we could look at those people being us. Are we one and the same, Native Americans and Africans? Are we one and the same? I believe we are. And the same tactic is being taken now that was taken then, that treaties and promises have been broken. How do we reinforce a treaty? And how do we make sure that people are not killed like cattle? The natives went to war because their cattle was being killed. Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull wanted Custer's people to stop killing the cattle. They were killing the cattle for no reason. They had come up on the cattle and decided to scatter and kill the cattle, not to consume it and eat it. As the Native Americans say, we only kill to survive. But they asked, this is quote, and I quote what the natives are saying, has the white man become a chow that they should kill the cattle and not eat? If they do not eat and they should kill this cattle, more than likely what is happening is you have a situation of waste. Once again, people being wasted away, and we're going to equate the people to cattle. We're going to equate the people to cattle, and this is likening to cattle the people. Just as you know, children and cattle were liking together, having no significance. And if we can waste away cattle, then the same parallel could be applied to wasting away people. A lot of needless killing and wasting away. I want you to think about that. And ladies and gentlemen, we want you to understand that as teachers, we're taking the frontline defense on speaking out against a lot of injustice and a lot of things that should not be transpiring, because we are the ones that bring about social studies and teach our children. We teach them the first step in civilizing themselves in civics. We teach them to look at religions and follow their rituals and traditions. We are the ones that lay the foundation, and we can no longer do this thing alone. We can no longer do this thing alone. And we're going to have your help. And we're asking for those of you out there who have some input and who have a stake in education to speak to us and tell us what are some of the options that we can do. And we're going to pause for a moment of silent peace to just bring peace into the room. And as we bring peace into the room, we're going to ask that you begin to think about out there on the battlefield of Custer and Crazy House, as their people were killed, what can we do to change things? Take a moment for silence. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, our guest has arrived, and we want to bring her right into the audience for the sake of time. Just to give you an overview, Mrs. Michelle Brown was with us on last Monday, and she will be talking about the continuation of what transpired and happened to her, the injustice that was done in her home, how she was not protected, and because of mistaken identity, she was not given a chance to express her opinion and given all the details. So today she's going to give us an overview as a teacher, and coming to you by way of Detroit, Michigan, and Chicago, Illinois. So I give you Mrs. Michelle Brown. I'm going to bring her. Michelle, you're live and you're on the air.
Good evening, and how are you today? I'm new to the area. Oh, that's good. I'm new to the area. I've been here a few months, and I basically feel that there needs to be some type of communication between law enforcement, the citizens, the residents of Indiana, particularly the area which I live, because there is no communication, and you don't know who anybody is. I think everything is very impersonal. And I think the more impersonality that exists within a community, the more corrupt acts can take place. I think when you can have a face to people and have accountability to their actions, then less of these situations will occur. So it including mistaken identity. If someone is saying that you're someone that you're not, it seems like they would have to have proof. They're going to show you paperwork or warrants or some place that you can clarify and say, oh, that person's not me. This person is this person. This is their birthday. That's not me. But there's no open lines of communication. It's just like somebody wants to just persecute someone. And from there, the course of action is just harassment, torture, and whatever else they have in store for a person. And I don't think that this is how a community needs to exist. And I think that people are too intelligent and too cultured to exhibit this type of behavior. Specifically in 2014, you just don't expect to experience these types of situations given the culture of people who want to learn, who care and respect about, and care and respect other people. So I find that very hard to deal with, particularly being a person who is cultured and a person who does respect people. So I would always like to communicate with people before I would have a situation with someone. I don't even know the residents who live in my building. I think that's not good either, because it's just, I don't know if they live there or if they're there for, I don't know. And I think that's a very bad thing. Everybody in an environment should know who their neighbors are. They should know who their police are. They should know the department district. They should know all the people who make that community function. And I think that is missing in the community that I have a situation of being falsely arrested, of being falsely charged, and being placed into jail for 3 days. I think all those things could have been avoided if people have a sense of community and accountability. Those things can't happen.
Mr. Brown, let me ask you a question. What kind of advice would you give the listening audience about if you're ever mistaken for false identity? What are some of the things you discovered that you could have asked for so that they could properly present whatever law you've broken and cite you what you're being indicted for? What could you have asked them during that particular
situation? Well, the officers that I dealt with were extraordinarily hostile, and they kept cutting me off abruptly. They didn't allow me to communicate with them. They had a job or intent to do what they intended to do, which was to arrest, and falsely accuse. They didn't want me to talk. Each time I would talk, they would allow me a second, and they would cut me off. So that was the justification for the mistaken identity, because they didn't want to clarify who I was. They just wanted to arrest and to injure. So I feel that if anyone has this particular experience where the person, there's a blockage, there's a language barrier, then the only thing that you can do is to just remain patient and hopefully nothing worse happens. But the thing about it is that you don't have power. The only person that has power are the people that come with the weapons, and they come with the apparatus to detain you and to harm you. But if you survive that, the only thing that you can really do is to pursue an attorney who hopefully will work on your behalf and for your interest. And the next thing is to contact all of your congresspeople and all of your representatives in that particular area to make them aware of the situation that you experience, as well as talking to other possible law enforcement agencies that you may have a connection to outside of that area. So I think a lot of times when people have had these kind of situations, they probably may take a long time to sort out if they do not talk to the right people that can make a decision or if they can stop something from occurring. So it's one thing about our judicial system, it can be a very long, arduous process. Lawsuits are very prestigious. They last a long time, and they can be continued for years. And no one wants to have that placed upon them unnecessarily. So,
And it could be very costly, too, I would add, Mrs. Brown.
Yes.
Let me ask you a question. Legal aid, how can legal aid play a part in this and make themselves visible to the community at large for helping people who have landlord-tenant issues or who have mistaken identity issues of the law enforcers perpetrating on you? How can the legal aid get involved and do something to make a difference?
Well, I feel that the one legal aid should be able to talk to anyone despite income. They should be able to have a general consultation with a resident or citizen of this country that may need legal help or may find themselves having a legal situation due to no circumstance of their own. And they should be able to tell them what steps they need to take to be able to correct that situation. And they should be able, if they're able to help a person, then the person would go through the application process and they would tell them how they qualify or not. But I think that they should be able to give general information to any citizen in the country or resident that lives here that has a legal issue.
What about the congressman? Do you feel that they have a legal obligation to helping the people when something like this happens in the community? And how can they get involved and to what extent should they be required to get involved to help someone who is incarcerated under a mistaken identity?
Well, I think that definitely the people, wherever that particular individual was detained, the congressional person and people involved with that congressional district and state representatives should be involved because these are the people that represent them in terms of our United States government. So I feel that they should be involved and they should know what is going on in their district and their respective locations that they serve. And they should be able to, if the resident contacts them, I think the representative or senator should be able to tell them the course of action they should take and how to correct the situation. Because they are our representative through government and they do know how our legal process works through the United States government. So if anyone would have that information or at least know as to how that process works, it would definitely be a government person.
And Mrs. Brown, do you feel that in getting due process that there shouldn't be no negotiation for taking a plea bargain, but to clear your record and expunge your record so that you will not have a flaw on your record as a teacher, how do you feel that they should handle that in the event that they're trying to find some charges to stick you with? What do you recommend to the listening audience about taking plea bargains and how should they handle that in talking to their representative to tell them that they don't want to take a plea bargain because they don't want their name scarred or their record to be not presentable for employment? What should they say to their lawyer and up front about the plea bargains? Because a lot of that has been going on.
Well, I think that they should definitely, I think the person knows their situation. They know whether or not they've done something wrong. I think as a person who has not committed any act or crime, meaning that there's not an injured party. There's no bruises, there's no cuts, there's no gunshot wounds, there's no property damage. I think in order for someone to basically hold you in custody, meaning that you're an endangerment to your environment, then someone or something has to be seriously injured. I don't think that people should be arrested when there is no evidence of any injury to anyone. So I feel that the only thing that was injured in terms of my situation was me because I had bruises and I hadn't done anything to break the law. I hadn't done anything to anyone besides pay my rent on time and go home and be quiet and not talk to anybody. And despite my peacefulness, my environment has not been peaceful to me.
Okay, once again, Ms. Bell, if an attorney recommends to that person that I've been assigned to your case and I'm offering you a plea bargain, And they're saying, in lieu of what? And they'll say, in lieu of going to jail. And at that particular point, should that person begin to say, well, I'm going to exercise a plea bargain, when in fact they know they're innocent? How should they proceed? Should they be persistent and saying, I would like a jury trial of my peers so we can prove my innocence?
Well, I think what happens is that people become intimidated because they're up against a machine that is really bullying people. So when someone threatens someone with jail time, particularly somebody who has never been to jail and they don't understand how the judicial system or the judicial process works, I'm sure they will be fearful of someone telling them, well, if you don't plea bargain, you're going to be in jail for so long. So a lot of people are basically intimidated into plea bargaining because they don't understand or they know that they're going to be run over. So they just feel like they'll take the less of the two evils. So if it means to be out of jail and to be free, they'll take the plea bargain as opposed to being innocent and being in jail and waiting to talk.
Right.
And then to be found, after all that time, to be found guilty, even though they hadn't done anything.
Well,
there's a lot of people who've been convicted of crimes that they have never committed. And that becomes very intimidating to people, particularly people who are innocent.
Now, Mr. Song, do you think the time is of essence between the time you go into court that they conveniently are looking at that absence of time where you're going to court and to put something else on you so that they can make the first thing stick? Is it very crucial that you should expediently try to get some help immediately and not wait until the court date because of the fact that you might have more than two other cases on the records that could also be false, and then it will be much more difficult to prove two indictments opposed to one? So what must a person do to expedite the process in not only securing a lawyer, but what can they do in a letter-writing campaign? How can they begin the process to help themselves? Self-help, that's what we're about here.
Well, the thing about it is that this society is so dissected. A lot of people do not have access to good counsel. They don't have access to the judicial processes, and they have been kept from people, basically. It's like the judicial system is a league of its own. It has its own members and club. So a lot of people are locked out of the process of being able to ameliorate anything on their own because they don't have the proper connections or anyone to hear them to correct the situation.
Now, what would you recommend so that they can get connected and get connected to the point where they're getting proper advice, and what are the steps that they should try to take to find someone to advocate for them?
Well,
this radio show is a means of advocating for you.
Media, I think, would be the best tool, because media should be a neutral site that enables the public to know about situations that are going on that are unfair for people. And there's a lot of unfairness and discrimination that is going on in our country, even in 2014, that needs to be broadcast.
Now, I understand that there was a gentleman, your brother was also involved. I understand that there was a gentleman that was involved, too, and they can actually have a different perspective. I like to get both sides of the perception. Is Mr. Brown in the audience? And would he care to speak? Okay.
Yeah, I can speak on this. Okay, what's the question?
Okay. Well, what was your take on the whole raid? And as a black man, how did you feel about the whole situation and the procedure? Was everything handled procedurally? Or do you feel that it was outside of the procedure?
Well, this procedure was out of whack, because even if any type of person is captured or taken or arrested, they have some kind of valid proof of a warrant, why you're being arrested. They say your Miranda rights. None of that was stated, even if it was going to make an arrest. There was nothing there. This is like an abduction out of your house. It's a seizure. The terrorism can't be any better. This is some act of terrorism right here. What you're talking about. A mile score, because somebody was murdered. So everybody's just arrested to show you who abuses and how bad you can be in this type of system, because you're dealing with bullies. And they have the privilege. They can have a privilege or entitlement to do that and put something on your record. This is what we have here.
Now, as a black man, knowing that this is a routine thing that happens to black men and not women, how did you feel when you were there and helpless, where you could not assist your sister, when you saw the dragging of this young lady? How did you feel at that point when you were told not to speak or you couldn't intervene.
I was captured. I was basically abducted. They grabbed, they had me, handcuffed me when I even questioned